Lecture 36, Voices of Victorian Poetry.
We tend to regard Victorian poetry as being nowhere near as high a literary achievement as the fiction of that age, or even the non-fictional prose of the Victorian period as it was practiced by high stylists like John Ruskin or Thomas Carlyle or Walter Pater. The last of those, Walter Pater, was an Oxford don, a patron of aestheticism. I'll just give you the last lines of Walter Pater writing about the Renaissance, because oddly enough they had quite an influence on poets of the time. What Pater is doing is he's recalling the grandeur, the moral grandeur, the stylistic grandeur of the Renaissance, and suggesting it should somehow be incorporated into modern life. How shall we pass most swiftly from point to point and be present always at the focus where the greatest number of vital forces unite in their purest energy? To burn always with this hard, gem-like flame, to maintain this ecstasy, is success in life. The Victorians, however, revered poetry with an intensity which is alien to us, even though we do not regard their poetry as highly as they did. And poetry in all its manifestations, from the music hall song and street ballad to the lofty utterances of the poet laureate, the bard, who you'll recall is appointed as personal versifier to the Queen, Queen Victoria. When the most eminent of those poet laureates died, Victorian poet laureates, he'd been appointed in succession to Wordsworth, he was given what was amounted to a state funeral. Now, it's Tennyson I'm talking about, and he was buried, or his body lay in state in St. Faith's Chapel in Westminster Abbey. And there were depictions, there were famous pictures of the night before the funeral. And the funeral itself was a huge event. People lined the route on the way to the interment, the ceremonial interment, in this place of honour. And the highest honour was accorded to the great Victorian laureate, Alfred Lord Tennyson. Now, it wasn't just, as it were, prestige. Poetry in the Victorian era was a best-selling commodity. And you can contrast it with the modern slim volume. It's been estimated, I think quite plausibly, that there are more writers of poetry than there are readers of poetry in the present day. It was very different in the Victorian era. Tennyson's narrative poems like Enoch Arden, it's the story of a sailor who's thought lost at sea. He's dead but not dead. He comes back to find his wife remarried, looks through a window, a very poignant scene. The Victorians loved that. But it sold at a Dickensian level. It was as popular as any of the popular novels of the day. Another one of Tennyson's narrative poems, Maud, which is about mad love, which is hopelessly disappointed, and the hero goes off to fight and die in the Crimean War. That again sold as well as any novel of the 1850s. And so too, Tennyson's great late work, Idylls of the King, in which he decided that he would take the whole saga of the knights of Arthur's Round Table and put it into verse. These, as I say, sold in quantities to rival Dickens himself. And Enoch Arden, for instance, the book I mentioned earlier, cleared 60,000 copies in its first year of publication. That would make it a bestseller in today's reckoning. And then, of course, it was a what we would call a superseller. Now, one can read these works like novels, although we've rather lost the knack. That's to say, we don't really like long poetry. The fashion of the 20th and 21st century is for shorter verse. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the spouse of Robert Browning, actually composed a verse novel. It's generally regarded, she wasn't the only person to do this, but hers is generally regarded as the best of the novels in verse. It's called Aurora Leigh. It's a very complicated story, and it does, as I say, require all sorts of skills which we've largely lost. We we can't hold poetry, a lot of poetry, in the mind for very long. The Victorians could. George Meredith, in his sonnet sequence, Modern Love, put together a narrative in this sequence of the gradual breakdown of a marriage. Again, a very powerful story in verse. So the Victorians did have a place for poetry, which we've rather lost. And they, as I said, they revered it. They consumed it in large quantity, and they were prepared to pay good money to consume it. Now, there was a galaxy of talent in Victorian poetry, names which the Victorians believed would live forever in literary history. This would be, to some extent, their grand monument. It hadn't quite turned out that way, but one thinks of names like, you know, Christina Rossetti and her brother Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, I've mentioned. Some of the great novelists we've already looked at, Emily and Charlotte Bronte, began by writing poetry, and a poetic vision is fused into their prose. It was, in fact, to simplify things, an age in which poetry mattered and poetry was everywhere. It was in the literary atmosphere. Now, in this lecture, I want to look at three great voices in Victorian poetry: Alfred Lord Tennyson, Robert Browning, and Gerard Manley Hopkins. Between them, I would suggest they represent the bridge from high romanticism, the romanticism of John Keats, if you like, to modernism, the 20th century. First, Tennyson. Tennyson carries on to its furthest extent the bequest of Keats, and also that other great romantic Shelley. What he offers is a kind of supercharged late period romanticism. Mellifluity, the music of the English language, has never been more skillfully composed into verbal melody and harmony than under Tennyson's hand. He incidentally is the first poet whose voice we have cracklingly preserved on the Pioneer phonograph. We can actually hear him reading, and we can actually hear his own inflections, and very revealing it is. Now let me, as best I can, read a portion of one of his Homeric poems. Tennyson was obsessed with the Odyssey, by the way. But where other poets, not least the original author, Homer, concentrate on the derring do, the battle, the ordeals, the clash on what Tennyson himself called the ringing plains of windy Troy, Tennyson is much more interested in melancholy, world weariness, spiritual lassitude. Now, this exhaustion was a central part, as far as we make out, of the Victorian psyche, along with the astounding dynamism and confidence which built Victorian England. I mean, the Victorians sank, for instance, 40% of their gross national product into capital ventures, bridges, roads, public building, railways, opposed to current Great Britain's 4%. The railways one travels on in Britain today, the subway system in the capital, London, and some 40% of the still standing housing stock, the very subterranean water pipes and the sewers under one's feet in London, all these were laid down and paid for by the Victorians. So they'd have this dynamism. But the reverse side of that was the melancholy, which Tennyson captured more eloquently than any of his contemporaries. Now, one of the episodes from the Odyssey which fascinated Tennyson, the arch-Victorian, was the Island of the Lotus Eaters, where, in fact, people would eat this plant and be taken over by the mood, cui bono, what is the point of it all? But listen to the word music. I'll do my best to get the Tennysonian twang, which, as I say, we can, in fact, actually verify by this early recording. Not of this poem, alas. The poem opens with Ulysses addressing his sailors. Courage, he said, and pointed towards the land. This mounting wave will roll us shoreward soon. In the afternoon they came unto a land in which it seemed always afternoon. All round the coast the languid air did swoon, breathing like one that hath a weary dream. Full-faced above the valley stood the moon, and like a downward smoke the slender stream along the cliff to fall and pause, and fall did seem. A land of streams, Some, like a downward smoke, slow dropping veils of thinnest lawn did go, and some through wavering lights and shadows broke, rolling a slumberous sheet of foam below. They saw the gleaming river seaward flow from the inner land, far off three mountain tops, three silent pinnacles of aged snow stood sunset flushed, and, dewed with showery drops, upclomb the shadowy pine above the woven copse. Like veils of thinnest lawn. Lawn is linen. It's wonderful. Tennyson knew from early life that he wanted to be a poet. He knew this when he was a student even at Cambridge. It was a career, a calling, his vocation. And this vocation was crowned when he became poet laureate in succession to Wordsworth in the 1850s. This was a high point of the era in other ways. It's sometimes called the Victorian heyday. There was the Great Exhibition of 1851, when in fact Britain showed off its industrial and technological prowess to the world. Tennyson was crowned again when Victoria, who loved his poetry and had been consoled by it when she lost her husband, Prince Albert, created him a baron, Lord Alfred Tennyson, in 1884. Alfred Lorne Tennyson, James Joyce satirically called him. He too obviously loved the Lotus Eaters and did his Homeric work as well, Ulysses, which we'll be talking about in due course. Tennyson's output was vast. Critical opinion, I think, would nominate as his greatest poem, and this was also Queen Victoria's favourite, the poem of religious faith and doubt, In Memoriam, which he wrote on the death of his male friend, Arthur Hallam. They'd been friends from college onwards, and the relationship was probably, although not actively, homosexual. Speculation's always raised on the topic, but we don't have to be offended by it. The Victorians would have been if they focused on, or if they accepted the fact, which, of course, none of them did. I want to concentrate on another famous work, however, which demonstrates Tennyson, the public poet. Now, poets could speak for the whole nation in the mid-Victorian period. And in 1854, 1855, Britain was at war. It was a strange war. It was the Crimean War. England and France, allies, oddly enough, at this point, had taken on Russia in Asia Minor. As it happened, an artillery officer called Leo Tolstoy was writing his first works of fiction on the enemy side in Sebastopol. It's a very obscure conflict, and best known probably for the heroic efforts of Florence Nightingale at Scutari, the military hospital where she brought about a revolution in nursing and patient care, the Lady with the Lamp, as she was called. It's also famous for a wonderfully futile cavalry charge, of which a watching French general, an English ally, remember, said, "C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la guerre." It's magnificent, but it isn't war. Now, the Crimean conflict was the first war to be covered by war correspondents and photographers. More particularly, the blunders, what we call the fog of war, was brought home as never before to the home population in England. William Howard Russell was a Times correspondent, and he'd been at Balaclava, and he'd seen this magnificent charge in which some English cavalry had actually been ordered into what was effectively a suicide mission. And in the Times, which was William Howard Russell's, the correspondent's paper, the phrase, "someone had blundered," was inserted in the report of this cavalry charge, this suicidal cavalry charge, on the 13th of November, 1854. The command had been given to charge the Russian guns, because they were firing right down into the cavalry as they were galloping towards these guns. 118 cavalry men were killed, 127 were wounded, 400 horses were destroyed. But the guns were eventually taken. It was, in a kind of grotesque way, a successful operation. This is Tennyson's very famous poem. And remember, this is a poem which would be read by hundreds of thousands of people in England at the time, while the event was still, as it were, reverberating. It was still recent. "Half a league, half a league, half a league onwards. All in the valley of death rode the 600. Forward the light brigade, charge for the guns," he said. "Into the valley of death rode the 600. Forward the light brigade. Was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply. Theirs not to reason why. Theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. Wonderful. And then, of course, the inevitable, someone had blundered. Now, this is poetry as quick in response almost as 24 hours rolling TV newscasts. And vivid, the galloping is mimetically caught, half-lick, half-lick, half-lick onwards. There's no attempt on Tennyson's part to vindicate the military stupidity which led to the slaughter. And as in most British wars, it's a case of lions being led by donkeys. Commanders are unworthy of the men they lead. This, in fact, is military history through the ages in Britain. As striking is the connection of poetry with new media. You know, Russell's telegraphed dispatches. The poem, as I say, was published in a newspaper a couple of weeks later with accompanying photographs. Never, one is inclined to say, has poetry been so relevant, so in touch with the great affairs of the day. Now, the partnering giant to Tennyson is Robert Browning. These were the two polar figures, in polar opposites in some ways, in the Victorian poetic universe. Browning is a more rugged and experimental verse maker than Tennyson. His early poem, Sordello, is so difficult that the Victorians like to say only God and Browning knew what it meant, and the poet had forgotten, so only God could read Sordello. It was so complicated. If Tennyson put music into poetry, Browning put thought into it, put a kind of quality of what one would call intellectualism. He did very unusual things, Browning, on a large, too large for us sometimes, I fear, on a very large canvas. The Ring and the Book, for instance, his great novel in verse, another one of those novels in verse I was talking about, looks at a 17th century murder in Italy from 12 different viewpoints, rather like the Japanese film Rashomon. Browning's major bequest to successive poetry is the dramatic monologue, which in fact is a voice-driven poetic form. There's very little stage drama of the Victorian period which has lasted, or which deserves to last, one might think. But the skilled use of voice, situation and scene, the mise-en-scène, the setting, as the French say, was brilliantly caught on paper by Browning. He had a wonderful ear. One example will have to serve from his most famous collection of dramatic monologues, Men and Women, which came out in 1855. The poem is called My Last Duchess. Before moving on to the poem, note the ambiguity of that word, last. Does it mean my late wife, or does it mean the most recent in a long line of duchesses? One of those questions which hovers over the monologue that follows. The situation is this. This is the dramatic setting. An Italian potentate, Browning and his wife, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, were fascinated by Italy and were sort of sucked in by Renaissance culture, and much of their verse reflects it. But the poem is based on an actual 16th century aristocrat, the Duke of Ferrara, who may or may not have been an uxoricide, a wife killer, but was certainly a great patron and connoisseur of the visual arts. And the situation, the actual dramatic situation, is the Duke showing off his art collection to an unidentified visitor. Suddenly, the Duke pauses at a particularly fine portrait. It is, he explained, his former wife, former Duchess. This is how the poem goes on. That's my last Duchess, painted on the wall, looking as if she were alive. I call that piece a wonder now. Fra Pandolf's hands worked busily a day, and there she stands. Wilt please you sit and look at her? I said Fra Pandolf by design, for never read strangers like you that pictured countenance, the depth and passion of its earnest glance, but to myself they turned, since none puts by the curtain I've drawn for you but I, and seemed as if they would ask me, if they durst, how such a glance came there. So, not the first are you to turn and ask thus. Sir, 'twas not her husband's presence only called that spot of joy into the Duchess' cheek. Perhaps Fra Pandolf chanced to say, her mantle laps o'er my lady's wrist too much, or paint must never hope to reproduce the faint half-flush that dies along her throat. Such stuff was courtesy. She thought, and cause enough for calling up that spot of joy. She had a heart, how shall I say, too soon made glad, too easily impressed. She liked whate'er she looked on, and her looks went everywhere. Sir, 'twas all one. My favourite her breast, the dropping of the daylight in the west, the bough of cherries some officious fool broke in the orchard for her, the white mule she rode with round the terrace, all and each would draw from her alike the approving speech, or blush at least. She thanked men, good, but thanked somehow, I know not how, as if she ranked my gift of a 900-years-old name with anybody's gift. Anyway, the poem goes on, and it emerges that in fact, he's so insulted by what he sees as this, as it were, this lack of respect for himself from his Duchess, that he killed her. And at the same time, he's immortalized her as this wonderful picture. What Browning is doing in this poem is putting into play the idea of art, of beauty, and human relationships, love, if you like. And on one level, the poem seems to be saying that art is more important than love. It's the residue. It is, if you look at the Italian Renaissance, who cares that the Borgias were murderers if, in fact, they produced this beauty? Or is the Duke Melia a sociopath, which, in fact, is what a moralist might say? Did he have her killed? The poem, in fact, doesn't make it clear. Or did he merely sort of just tell her off and she died of natural causes? Is he a callous sadist, a bluebeard, or merely an aesthete, someone who's taken a cuckold's consolation in his collection of art treasures? The poem, in fact, makes us think, and this is Browning's great achievement as a poet, that, in fact, as I say, he introduces thoughtfulness into his poetry and induces thoughtfulness in his reader. Now, if Tennyson looks back to Shelley and Keats, from Browning we can trace lines of connection forward to Ezra Pound, W.B. Yeats, T.S. Eliot. That command of voice, that creation of what became known in Yeats's terms as persona, the mask through which the poet writes impersonally, would be a very important instrument in the creation of 20th century verse. And that toughness too, that toughness of mind, It strikes us as a modern thing. Now, I want to move on to the last poet in this trio, Gerard Manley Hopkins. And that, I think, does take us forward unequivocally in a great leap into modernism, into the 20th century. Now, it's as true in literature as anywhere else that, as the 1930s song put it, nobody loves you till you're dead and gone. And some highly successful literary careers have not got off the ground until their authors were long under the ground. And Gerard Manley Hopkins, among canonical poets, was a total unknown to the poetry reading public until 20 years after his death. That death occurred in 1889. He lived his life as a Jesuit priest. He wrote poetry as a very personal thing, something that only existed between him and his journal. Arguably, he's one of the very greatest of Victorian poets, of whom no Victorian had the slightest, or very few Victorians had the slightest awareness that he was a poet. Tennyson had a readership of millions for The Charge of the Light Brigade. The poem was given away as a free sheet at his funeral. Gerard Manley Hopkins had at best a readership of just two. His literary resurrection was entirely thanks to his friendship with the 20th century poet laureate Robert Bridges, a figure over whom, ironically, time has thrown a much heavier spadeful of forgetful earth than ever covered his obscure Jesuit friend Gerard Manley Hopkins. For every million schoolchildren who read The Wind Hover, not one nowadays would even know the name of Bridges' magnum opus, The Testament of Beauty. Working by himself, but with an awareness of the techniques devised by Tennyson and Browning, Hopkins broke through Victorianism into modernism. If one compares that poem, The Lotus Eaters, for instance, with the lushness of one of Hopkinson's description of landscape, we can see where he's coming from, but see how far he's left it behind. This is Hopkins describing a landscape. Cloud puffball, torn tufts, tossed pillows, flaunt forth, then chevy on an air-built thoroughfare. Heaven roisterers in gay gangs. They throng, they glitter in marches, down rough cast, down dazzling whitewash. wherever an elm arches, shive lights and shadow tackle in, long lashes, lace, lance and pear. Delightfully the bright wind, boisterous ropes wrestles, beats, earth bare of yester tempest's creases. In pool and rut peel parches, squandering ooze the squeezed dough-crust dust. Stanches, starches, squadroned masks and man-marks, treadmire toil, their foot-fretted in it. It's in fact sort of too much, but in fact that's exactly what Hopkins wanted. Now, what Hopkins has done is to create poetry around stress, what he calls sprung rhythm. He goes right the way back to Anglo-Saxon verse. His poetry is constructed on stress, not meter. He freed English poetry from the chains of the pentameter, di-dum, 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 di-dum. He realised that the form of the future would be the short lyric, which did interesting things with language, with the English language. That's where poetry must return to, and it must conduct experiments with language, while retaining a sustaining link with tradition in the subject matter. In this case, he's writing, as all poets through the ages have written, about the world, the natural world around him. Let me give an idea of what I'm talking about here with one of a group of Hopkins's poems. That group is called the Terrible Sonnets. Now, what these record is a dark night of the soul, which is a well-known trial of Catholic conscience. It goes back to the poetry composed by St. John of the Cross. The poet feels some of the pangs of Jesus, but can he endure them? Can he, as it were, call on that patience, a word which literally means suffering, in order to get through this trial and come through it stronger, as indeed Christ did on the cross? This is the terrible sonnet. It's called No Worst There Is None, after the first line. No worst there is none, pitched past pitch of grief, more pangs will, schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. Comforter, the Holy Ghost, where is your comforting? Mary, mother of us, where is your relief? My cries heave, herds long, huddle in amain, a chief woe, world's sorrow, on an age-old anvil wince and sing, then lull, then leave off. Fury had shrieked, no lingering, let me be fell, force I must be brief. Oh, the mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed, hold them cheap may who ne'er hung there, hanging as on the cross. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind, all life, death, does end, and each day dies with sleep. One recalls here Lear, all that the thing about the what comfort serves in a whirlwind recalls Lear on the heath. One recalls Prometheus on his rock every morning, harrowed by the harpies who come to peck out his liver. But most of all, one recalls Christ. What is the root cause of all this pain? Sexual temptation, sexual frustration, he's a celibate, religious doubt, innate melancholy, what we would call clinical depression. The poem is a superb articulation of mood, of an extreme state. But where, in what, does that mood originate? These are issues which every reader of the poem must decide on for themselves. Now, these three poets, I propose, constitute a line or tradition connecting the Romantic to the modern period of literature. Victorian poetry, whose surface is only time enough to scratch here, is not a static thing. It's an entity. It's a dynamic continuum. It's, if you like, a thoroughfare or a corridor, which is taking literature 100 years forward and making possible the great achievements of the 20th century. I began by saying that we don't read Victorian poetry as avidly and as commonly, as in such a widespread way, as we honour the memory of the Victorian novelists. But I think we should actually be aware of them. And not only that, we should, as it were, sample their greatest works and appreciate what they were doing, what they were building, just, as I said, like the water pipes and the sewers under our feet, just like the British railways. We owe the Victorians a lot, but the modern poet, modern literature, in fact, owes the Victorian poet a lot.